attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. I'm your host Conrad. I'm joined by my co-host Will.
Hello.
And today's guest is a journalist for National File and The Political Insider. It's Jack Hadfield.
Hi guys, great to be on.
So first sort of question is, obviously, how did you first get into journalism and sort of writing for these websites?
Well, it was really just an accident of circumstances. I campaigned for the Conservative Party in the 2015 election on their big battle bus thing, which I think was eventually mired in scandal at the end. I think I was aware with Conservative Future and that getting shut down and that. But anyway, I met this guy there, Charlie, at the Victory Party in July of that year. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, do you want to start writing for my little website thing? And I was like, oh yeah, sure. But I had never considered journalism as an opportunity in the past. But I thought, you know what, let's just go for it and see how it goes. And so I started writing this little thing called the Squid Magazine, and got to the point where through various things we were interviewing Milo Yiannopoulos. And you know, we were quite excited about it because he was quite a big figure back at the time. Obviously, he's dropped a bit off the radar now. But we were interviewing him and he said, look, guys, Breitbart is starting up. You know, they're giving me their own vertical, which is the tech section. And we need reporters. So would you guys like to come write for us? And we were like, hell yeah, obviously. You know, this is sort of, you know, this dream come true. Obviously, Breitbart being this, you know, the biggest sort of, I guess, sort of alternative media. It's certainly moved more into sort of regular media now, but certainly at the time it had this sort of punkish vibe, you know, where they really seem to be breaking the mold and sort of pushing stories that other people weren't writing about. So yeah, it was really a dream come true. And this was, so I went into my first year at university, and I think on my 19th birthday I wrote my first article for Breitbart, and it was actually about Warwick University and the consent classes. So you know, 2 weeks into my university career I'm already causing trouble. But yeah, so that's sort of the quick backstory of how I got into journalism and media and that.
Now, you mentioned the piece that you wrote on the consent classes, and if I recall, you got quite a bit of backlash for that. How did you react to that when you saw the reaction from people who had read the piece?
Well, yeah, there certainly was a little bit of backlash, but thankfully it was nothing really compared to what my friend George Lawler, who wrote the original piece in the Tab that I was responding to. He put a photo on his Facebook, been holding the book, you know, so you've been publicly shamed. You know, he was getting stuff from, because the story went international, he was getting stuff from people all around the world, and I only got a little small taste of sort of the viciousness that some people could have for putting out their opinion. Since then I've had lots of nasty messages and, you know, and Twitter DMs and since the past. Certainly the first time it happens to you, you know, you are taken aback quite a little bit at how mean some people can genuinely be for having a difference of opinion. But you know, that's the internet, and I've certainly got used to it now. And now, you know, if somebody sends me hate mail, I consider it a little badge of honor that I've managed to annoy somebody that much with, you know, my ramblings that they feel they need the time to come and swear at me online.
Now, in this part of your current work at the National File, you went to CPAC in America. What was that like?
Oh, sorry, I think I just muted my mic there. It was, wow, an incredible experience. obviously for those of you listening to podcast now, I don't know it. It's really the equivalent of Conservative Party conference, but in America and non-partisan. So it's not. So there are lots of Republicans there. I met quite a few congressmen, Matt Gaetz, Paul Gosar. You know, there were loads. Obviously, President Trump himself gave a speech, and I was lucky enough to see. Even though I was at the back of the room, I managed to get onto the because I was press, I managed to get onto the balcony where all the cameras were, where people were recording it. So I got, you know, a relatively decent view. But it was insane to see all these people that, you know, I've, you know, watched and listened to online, and then, you know, they're all in this place. You know, obviously, Alex Jones was there. He was at one of the events, some of the events the National File hosted. Michelle Malkin, you know, the Conservative commentator, who's really big on border control and immigration and issues like that. It was certainly an incredible experience, definitely one that I recommend. But I definitely caught something when I was over there, because on the Sunday, on the way back, I was just coughing and spluttering, and it turned out there was somebody at CPAC who actually did get the coronavirus. So I was certainly concerned that I might have caught it for a bit after that. So that was the only downside. I came back and had about 10 days of just coughing my lungs up. But other than that, you know, if you are a Conservative or even just anybody who's interested in politics, you know, if you can afford it, I would definitely recommend going over there at some point in your life.
Now, you mentioned that it's equivalent to, say, the Conservative Party conference. What do you think are the differences in approaches to conservatism in the United States as compared to the UK?
I mean, that's certainly a tough question. But really, I think the fact that American conservatism, well, if you sort of say American conservatism pre-Trump, then it's pretty obvious to see what the differences were. In that American conservatism was really just classical liberalism, you know, in that it was all focused on rights, freedoms, liberties, you know, small government, you know, cutting taxes, cutting government debt, very much focused on the economy and the free market. And that was the stuff they promoted now, as opposed to sort of English conservatism, which has always had that Burkean heritage and the idea of sort of Hobbes and Moore of the natural order of things, in that American conservatives, you know, they had always been worried about using the government, whereas British conservatives never really had those qualms in doing so. Certainly the use of the government is something that they would that was certainly a big difference. But with Trump, you're starting to see people more like Tucker Carlson coming up in the conservative movement, who are more into promoting stuff like the family. And I think the Tucker Carlson versus Ben Shapiro debate that was done a couple of years ago, I think on Shapiro's Daily Wire podcast, you can really see the two trends of American conservatism, with Ben Shapiro being the classic American, you know, all about, you know, free market and, you know, you're not entitled to anything, just the pursuit of happiness kind of thing, and Tucker Carlson speaking about how the free market is not a god, you know, capitalism is not some Nicene creed that we worship. And was more opposed, was more creating families and communities, and something that looks more like traditional English conservatism. So there seems to be this merge together of the two conservative traditions, where the American conservative movement is moving away from this really classical liberal trend with perhaps some vaguely social conservative values to something that is more akin to British English conservatism.
Now, you mentioned that after you got back from the conference, you were ill, and obviously we've got the coronavirus pandemic going on at the moment. You know, maybe you had it, you haven't been tested, so you don't know.
Yeah.
What is your view on the sort of way the situation's been treated across the world and in the UK specifically?
Well, yeah, I certainly started with the pandemic thinking, oh yeah, you know, it's just a flu, bro. I'm thinking that, oh, we'll all blow over, you know, we've had bird flu and Ebola, and that didn't really affect anyone in the end, like in the grand scheme of things. Obviously, you know, though it was serious, but it was nowhere near the scale that we've had now. And as it's gone on more, I've started to think that, yeah, you know, I really am glad that, well, certainly I think within the last half an hour or so, Rishi Sunak announced £330 billion, I think, in, you know, government spending going to businesses to keep them afloat. And, you know, I wrote a story for the National File at the weekend, which talked about all the new powers that I think the legislation is going to be pushed through within the next 2 weeks in terms of shutting down ports, potentially closing down pubs, restaurants, etc., giving police powers to detain people who have been suspected for having the coronavirus and so on. I'm certainly glad that the government has turned around from its previous way of tackling the coronavirus, which talk about herd immunity and things like that. I think they've admitted that would certainly cause a problem. So there has been a quick turnaround today on that. And yeah, it's certainly glad to see, you know, governments actually taking charge and doing stuff that they can to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. It's certainly annoying with people who are saying, oh, you know, well, especially Americans who have this anti-government trend, as I mentioned earlier, who are talking about, oh, no, you can't stop us from going out. It's my right to go and do this. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, if you do that, you're probably going to end up killing people from spreading this virus about. And people in the 70s are saying, oh, you know, I'm fit and healthy. I cycle 8 miles a day. I'll be fine. It's like, yeah, but you're still in your 70s. Your immune system's weaker than everyone else, and you're at greater risk. So certainly the people who really aren't taking this seriously are definitely a threat to everybody else. And yeah, I'm very glad with the responses that Western governments are taking in order to crack down and, yes, stopping this pandemic from becoming something akin to the Spanish flu.
Now, you mentioned the intervention from the government relating to the coronavirus, but of course, even before we've seen the measures that are in place at the moment, we were seeing in the budget greater government involvement in the market and things like that. How much government involvement in society do you think is appropriate, and what was your reaction to the recent budget?
Well, I mean, the question about government involvement in society is certainly one that really changes with the time, certainly in terms of crises like this. I don't have a problem with the government stepping in to do what it takes to stop society from completely internally collapsing and stopping the economy from going into a crippling recession. But most of the time, in general, I think government generally needs to step back from society and let people operate as they would. I think most of the problems now that you see in society have been caused by overt government intervention. However, in order to fix these things, you ironically need somebody in government to sort of reverse them, because once they've been checked, for example, you know, with mass migration, for example, that was Blair opened the borders in 1997 and allowed what was between tens of thousands of migrants per year to multiple hundreds of thousands. And obviously that has a huge effect on society. But you couldn't just say, okay, great, and government steps back and sorts it. No, you would need the government to come in, for example, and reduce immigration. That's sort of an example of things that where government's made the problem, but it's also such a problem that government needs to fix it as well. But yeah, certainly. And with regards to the budget, I haven't had a look at that much in general. But certainly, I think the leveling up agenda that Boris promised in the manifesto to towns in the north and the Midlands, which didn't seem to get the benefits of the growing economy that we've had since the Thatcher Revolution, and fulfilling the promises in the manifesto, I think were really important. I think that really now keeping those northern seats that Boris won in the 2019 general election is certainly something that's more important than necessarily, you know, paying down the debt or you know, trying to lower taxation or so on. There's definitely, we need the big infrastructure spending, certainly that they announced, and just reinvestment to, again, in these places, which is a problem that government caused when Thatcher shut down the mines and so on. Yes, obviously they were losing money, but then they were like, oh, it's fine, you know, the market will take care of it. But nothing came in to replace it. So you need government to step in, invest in these areas and bring back businesses and revitalize the economies of these areas that have been left behind. So the budget last week was really good. And certainly, and again, to reiterate, Sunak's spending of $330 billion to help with the coronavirus outbreak is something that I can very much get behind.
Now, across the pond, we've got the Democratic primary, which is still going on as we record, though there is a few primaries today. So who knows what the case will be by the time this actually goes out. But as it stands now, there are still two candidates, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. Do you think either of these guys would be a threat to Donald Trump, or which one do you think would be the greater threat out of the two?
Well, I mean, you know, just to be clear, there are still three candidates standing, obviously, with my favourite, Tulsi Gabbard. You know, look, guys, you know, I mean, she's still in the race. You know, she hasn't dropped out yet. So technically, there's still three in there. But yeah, you know, she has absolutely no hope, even though I think, you know, personally, she would certainly be the best out of the three to actually beat Donald Trump. But yeah, with Biden and Sanders, yeah, I don't think there's any way that either of them could beat Trump. I think it's almost a done deal, sort of touch wood, that he would win in November. Biden, certainly, you know, he likes sniffing hair. You know, he says weird things about when he was used to be a lifeguard and hang out with people with really random names, and he seems to have some form of dementia / Alzheimer's with his amount of gaffes. Yeah, I think he couldn't remember what God was. He confused. I think when he said he was trying to work with Xi Jinping, but he said he worked with Deng Xiaoping, who'd been dead for 20 years on reversing climate change. The amount of gaffes just isn't normal. I certainly think a Biden-Trump debate, you know, Trump would absolutely tear him apart. People say that Sanders would be able to win back the Rust Belt states like Michigan and Wisconsin and so forth. But in terms of getting out one of the crucial votes for the Democrats, the African American vote, he would do horribly on that. And I think that, you know, like Corbyn, people would say, oh, you know, but he's getting the youth and he's re-energizing them. It's like, yeah, no, it's not going to work. I certainly think we're going to see a second term for Trump.
Do you not think that if there's a recession, which there most certainly will be, caused by coronavirus, that would have an adverse impact on Trump's re-election chances?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, you just said it yourself. It's been caused by coronavirus. You know, this is something that Trump can say, look, you know, the economy was doing great. You know, this is all, we had the stock market up to whatever thousands of points. But, you know, what's happened was something that was completely out of anybody's control. And in fact, it almost vindicates Trump's agenda. I think there have been a number of think pieces saying that, you know, the coronavirus outbreak is, you know, crushing globalization dead. You know, as people have said, as people have been worried about supply chains getting stuff out of China, they were saying, well, I think there's an executive order that's being drafted up now by Trump's trade guy who are saying, you know, we're getting China out of the medical supply chains because this is something that we need to produce ourselves. And I think, certainly in terms of, Trump's trade war against China, Trump's policies towards China, and in terms of how integrated they are with the US economy, you know, Trump can point to that and say, look, and again, with Trump's, people were, before the outbreak really came to the US, he proposed a travel ban from China. People were saying the travel ban was racist. And again, Trump would be able to point to that and said, you know, the coronavirus outbreak here wouldn't be as bad if these people hadn't tried to, stop me from tackling these issues. So, yeah, I certainly think that obviously there's going to be problems with the economy, but nobody could blame it on Trump. And if the Democrat nominee tried to blame it on Trump, then the American people would definitely reject that narrative.
I just wondered what your reaction would be, because you mentioned some of the gaffes with Joe Biden and some of the forgetfulness. What your reaction would be to people who might suggest, oh, well, the same could apply to President Trump. How would you respond to that?
Oh, there's no comparison. Trump may say idiotic things from time to time, but he doesn't seem to have the, you know, constant, you know, as you may say, you know, brain farts that Joe Biden seems to have. You know, the fact that, you know, you could probably point out Trump's kafefe tweet as you know, this thing, but yeah, Biden, I mean, you could even compare videos of Biden from now to 4 years ago or 8 years ago. If you look at him, he just seems like a completely different guy in speaking. Trump, you know, may say things wrong at the time. I think he, you know, swore under his breath while he was C-SPAN were still broadcasting him before an address on the coronavirus last week. But, you know, it's absolutely nothing compared to Biden's clear, you know, memory problems.
Do you think that it was the right thing to hold the primaries today that are still going on? The Ohio governor delayed the Ohio primary until, I think, June, whereas the Florida, Illinois and Arizona primaries are still continuing. Do you think that's the right decision, or do you think they should have been delayed as well until the outbreak is under control?
Yeah, I certainly think they should have been delayed as well. You know, if you're getting, you know, hundreds or, you know, 1,000 people at polling stations, you know, casting their votes, and especially older people, you know, that is like the number one, you know, place where people could certainly get infected. So it's, I definitely respect the Ohio governor for shifting back this primaries. Again, yeah, you know, they've got lots of time anyway before the DNC and RNC, which are in July and August respectively, I believe. So yeah, they've got more than enough time to get this all sorted out before the actual general election. And yeah, people's health and safety really does need to come first.
I wondered what your thoughts are, because we're not only going to be seeing a presidential election this year, but we're also going to be seeing elections to the Senate. What do you think are the chances of the Republicans maintaining control of the Senate?
I haven't actually looked at the states which have the senators going up for election this time around, but I think they have a decent chance. And certainly, you know, if Trump wins the presidential election, you would expect that you would have this coattail effect where Republicans are more likely to win their races. But, you know, I think, what is it, 52-48 currently in the Senate?
Yeah.
It's really, really close. And it could certainly go either way.
I think it's, isn't it 53-47? But that includes Mitt Romney. I don't know if you'd include Mitt Romney.
Well, of course. Well, I think Romney proposed UBI yesterday, didn't he? Temporary UBI for the coronavirus outbreak. Yeah, so it may turn out that Andrew Yang is the real winner of of this crisis after all. The Neats are finally going to get their Yang bucks. All thanks to the coronavirus. But yeah, as I said, it certainly depends on the electoral map. Depends which states are going up. As I said, I'm not 100% sure which senators are up, going up for re-election. You know, it's obviously like British council elections, obviously, which were delayed this year. But you know, if you're having a load of rural councils, all being elected, you know, it probably wouldn't be a surprise that the Conservatives are going to win most of them again. And if it's a lot of urban councils, you know, Labour, you know, usually win most of them. It's just a question of the electoral map, who we've got coming re-elected. And yeah, it's going to be pretty close. But I think the Republicans have got enough wiggle room that they will maintain control of the Senate. I can't see the Democrats necessarily taking it back.
Overall, the picture on the right is sort of seemingly moving in a more kind of populist direction. What do you think the role in sort of technology and the internet has been in this movement?
I certainly think that the internet has, what the internet and social media done, what the internet and social media have done is sped up change massively in terms of the democratization of information. You know, if you compare now to 20 years ago, you know, where could you get your news? You know, you would get it from the newspapers, television, radio, and maybe if you were, you know, a weird geek, there might be some couple internet forums, you know, around at the time. But certainly, you know, people would get their information, their arguments, you know, they would get them from, you know, these mainstream sources. Whereas now, where you have the internet, where you have social media, where you have YouTube, people are exposed to a far wider range of opinions, both on the right and the left. And you're really seeing, political establishment not being able to control the flow of information, and again, that people are exposed to stuff that they might agree with. I have my views now because I've spent, you know, years on the internet from school, you know, be it Twitter or Tumblr and Facebook and YouTube, and seeing stuff that I wouldn't have seen, seeing arguments that I haven't been exposed to. Like, I became pro-life because I was, it was something I didn't really think about, but then somebody exposed the arguments to, you know, for me, and I was like, oh yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. You know, that would have never happened without the internet. Certainly, I think people's views are being broadened, and people are a lot more open to different ideas and the flows of different ideas. But of course, then some of the problem with the social media is that it can become a bit of an echo chamber. So certainly you have to make sure you're keeping being exposed to different ideas and different ways of looking at things, so that, you know, you don't get stuck into just a small community and, you know, you go down like conspiracy theories, and you think that, oh, man didn't land on the moon, and you wouldn't be willing to listen to anybody who tells you otherwise. So certainly that's the downside that comes with this. But yeah, the internet, social media, and the democratization of information and communications has been, has been a net positive overall.
Now, we're just coming up to the end of the podcast, but I've got one final question. Now, obviously, you've had to isolate due to your symptoms. A lot of people are having to isolate themselves for a bit longer. What do you think is the best sort of thing to do if you're isolating in terms of entertaining yourself? What will you do to entertain yourself?
Oh, well, I'm a regular listener to the Debater podcast, so I was wondering what my final question would be. I should have expected this one, the topic. A friend of mine messaged me earlier and asked me for a lot of Netflix recommendations, and pretty much every film and TV series I put to her, she'd already watched. So perhaps, if you're somebody who does a lot of binge watching already, you might want to switch it up, maybe read a book, go on a walk, and stay 2 meters away from everyone at all times, or just sleep, if you're not doing anything else with your day. But right now, me, I'm being productive and just spending my time, just getting things done that I needed to do, ticking off my list. Get my room tidy, getting things organized, and so I'm spending the coronavirus outbreak getting stuff done. I think one thing that if you're really nerdy you could do is you could be like Isaac Newton when he confined himself to his house during the Great Plague in 1665, and he calculated pi to about 20 places by hand. It took him hours and hours and hours and days using this really long mathematical formula. So if you're into that, maybe have a crack at that yourself.
Well, I think that's a good answer. So thank you for joining us, Jack. Feel free to, if you want to come to the podcast again, we'd love to have you on.
Absolutely.
And thank you to everyone for listening. If you want to get in touch, you can go on Facebook, Debated Podcast, on Twitter, Debated Podcast, and email us at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. You can listen to us on iTunes or on Spotify, Podbean, all sorts of places. So make sure you subscribe and keep an eye out for the next episode.